Welcome to Start Writing. I'm Joe Bendosky. Today I have an interview with Tim Niederreiter. He started reading fantasy and sci fiction when he was 5 and was first introduced to The Hobbit. He studied English literature in college and he continues to write sci-fi and fantasy. He's written quite a few novels available on Amazon and short stories. For this podcast, we read The Mangrove Suite, which was quite good and I do recommend it. Tim writes very well. And it was an enjoyable story. It's near future sci-fi. So with not necessarily alien invasion. It's kind of the post-alien invasion, but not necessarily post-apocalyptic world either. And so, you know, if that's your genre and you're looking for something interesting, I do recommend Tim's book. It was quite good. In the interview, we talk about him serializing novels as a panster and being able to use Patreon to sell those serialized novels as he's experimenting with that frame. He has two podcasts that he runs, Live After Reading, where I did an interview, and of Mooks and Monsters, which is a role-playing podcast for people who enjoy role-playing games. And so here is the interview. All right, so this is my guest, Tim Niederreiter, and he actually runs a series of podcasts, among which is Alive After Reading. Do you want to maybe talk about some of the other shows you're doing and why you have so many projects going?
Well, I do one other podcast that's audio only, that's Of Mooks and Monsters, and I do that with my co-host, Rob Ward, and he's an actor, and I'm a writer, but we're both gamers. We both love role-playing games. But Alive After Reading is the one I do by myself, and that's just me reaching out to other writers and creative people and talking to them. To jump back and forth, Of Mooks and... I know that's probably confusing, but Of Mooks and Monsters, the show I do with the co-host, is all about running better RPGs, and sometimes it's about playing RPGs on the air.
All right, so you're an author. I saw you have several, at least short stories up on Amazon. I didn't see if you've got a full novel on there yet. And then I've seen that you're working on a serialized novel that you're going to be releasing through Patreon. So just to give the listeners here an idea of what you write, why don't you pick your favorite published piece of fiction or even your to-be-released Patreon piece and give us the premise and the pitch of the story.
All right, so the basic pitch for my favorite is currently... Well, I'll do the pitch for the first one because there's two in this series now, but this novella, The Mangrove Suite, is a near-future cyberpunk novel that features a lot of... that deals a lot with memory, and it takes place in an alien occupation of the Earth, more or less, of this city. And And it involves people that are able to network mentally. The computers have all been eliminated by the aliens, or the occupiers. And this man finds a woman whose memory has been erased that he once knew. And he tries to set out to restore her memory.
Okay. Interesting. All right. And is that the one that's going out through Patreon?
No, that one went out in August. That's on Amazon. It's exclusive
okay.
right now.
Okay. So I thought probably one of the most interesting things I see you having gone here is the releasing a serialized novel through Patreon. And as I was listening to some of your episodes, I know at least one of your other authors that you've interviewed is doing the same thing. And in the indie publishing world, this is not something I've encountered before. I know authors release extra content on Patreon, but I've never seen someone serialize it. So talk to me about the decision to do a serialized novel and to release that through Patreon.
Yeah, well, that really happened in two steps because I've actually serialized a novel before just on my website. 10 Liars is this big epic fantasy. I actually serialized the whole trilogy on my website, mentalsellerpublications.com. Shouldn't say that all in one go, but still. That's a big fantasy novel with firearms as a major feature of it and its magic system. But And it really does fit into the same genre as the new book that I'm serializing on Patreon, which is really just an attempt to monetize what I was going to do anyway.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Yeah. Because releasing the book on my website, while it did get a lot of attention to the website at the time, I did not see a lot of carryover to people actually wanting to buy the book when it came out. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I've known authors who serialize novels to Amazon. They'll release, you know, a chapter or two chapters at a time in, you know, 99 cent little pieces. So why Patreon as opposed to an Amazon serial release?
Well, Patreon is a nice way to, honestly, I wanted to do it to get more in touch with the fans.
Okay.
Because I don't have a lot of fans yet. I'm a pretty new writer, but, I wanted to kind of use this as a source of community. And I've noticed that people are willing or more willing to follow you if there's a place they can go where they know they can support you. I mean, I think most authors out there, no matter how new they are, I mean, have people who want to support them, want to help them with their career. For example, you mentioned my guest on Alive After Reading, Alexandra Penn,
who's
doing the same thing. And she makes it, I mean, to me, it seems like a decent amount for the story, the amount of stories she releases every few weeks. It seems like she makes a pretty good bit of money for that. It's not, you know, incredible, but it seems like a reasonable sum. And I thought that would be worth my while. Because you don't have to, because honestly, you don't have to release that much fiction on Patreon, from what I've seen, to make compelling story and make people want to follow you.
So I imagine that if you're releasing a serial novel, then you're probably very much an architect or a plotter, as they say, right? You got to have this pre-planned out. No,
not at all. Okay, I'm actually, yeah, go on.
I was going to say, so you serialized a novel before, so you're a pantser or a gardener, whichever phrase you like. So talk to me about writing a serialized novel as a pantser and releasing it so you can't go back. Talk to me about that process. That sounds crazy.
No, it does, doesn't it? Well, you know, I'd write the, and I did take a big break in the middle of 10 Liars. That was one thing, because I knew I had to refocus. So I took like a month off of releases. And I didn't even write in the story at that point. I just went back because I was falling behind. But anyway, the way I started out writing it, I was saying, okay, all I have to do is write about 3,000 or 4,000 words a week, and then I edit those words, and then I'm going to release them. And that's also generally what people think is the dumbest way to do a serial. I just really wanted to write this story, and I'm like, this is the new story, and I want to get this out to people very quickly. And that was with 10 Liars. And it is very difficult, it turns out, to do this. And I'm not sure if I would do it again to that extent. The new story, Rise of Voda, that I'm doing on Patreon, is already mostly written. I've already got 60,000 words for it. So I'm mostly editing to fix stuff and to make it a better story, because I've had that novel sitting on my hard drive for quite a while.
Mm.
It's going to, at some point, I will have to add a bunch of new words to it. You know, probably 30,000 or 40,000 more at least, if not a lot more than that, because it is, again, another big fantasy novel, and I see this one as being, I mean, it's a more urban fantasy, but it's actually very similar in genre to 10 Liars, because they're both technological fantasies. Anyway, as far as the challenges of writing that, I definitely thought writing the story as I went, it didn't bother me at the time. That strikes me as odd myself. Like, you know, I didn't have a plan for where the story went. I did have a plan that I was going to do with basically three big parts with 10 Liars. So I was going to have the first third, the middle, and then the last third. And those were basically going to be each just a separate book. But that was about it for planning.
Okay. So that's the planning going in. So what happened? You're like, I got to take a month off. I've got to refocus this thing. So talk to me. How did you get to that point, and what did you do to fix it?
Okay. This was about after I'd finished gotten to the 2/3 point of the book. So I just about finished the second, the middle of the novel, or the series. And it really got difficult to see where I was going. I really didn't, and I was losing enthusiasm. This happens to me about a third or somewhere in the middle of all my books, actually, pretty much. I've written a bunch of books, and I usually I'm not doing it in public, which is why it's usually a lot easier to just say, I'm not doing this. But I pushed on until I got to the 2/3 mark before I took the break. And then I said, okay, that's basically a stopping point, so people are okay. You know, now that I think about it, I'm not sure if I got to the stopping point, though. Anyway, I wish I could remember. I did this only a couple years ago or a year ago. But it was such a whirlwind, and I must have driven myself a little crazy trying to write about 4,000 or 5,000 words every week and then publishing it.
Yeah. Well, I think 4,000 or 5,000 words a week, I guess, depending on your writing lifestyle. For me, you know, that's a day. Mm-hmm. But to edit that, to revise it, to clean it up for publication in a week does sound a little intense.
Yeah, that's the challenging part.
Yeah, like cranking out a first draft, not an issue, you know, if that's the length you need. But getting that ready to publish and coherent, that's another animal.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with that. I think I can write, I've written, you know, sometimes I've done 10,000 words in a day. That's not something I've done a lot lately. But yeah, 4,000 or 5,000 words a day seems very reasonable to me with the amount of time I have to do it.
Okay, so what was the problem at that 2/3 mark that the story had, and how did you fix it? And, you know, like, because it seems like I am at, like, there's a lot of problems that come out as I'm writing out a first draft that I think, thank goodness nobody gets to see this. I can clean this up in post.
Right. So the problem I ran into was more or less that I was worried about. I honestly think it mostly comes down to me. There wasn't that much wrong with the book, but I was very worried about what I was going to do. And this happens every time. If I had somebody, it's like that Neil Gaiman quote. Have you heard of this Neil Gaiman story?
Which one?
The one where he calls his editor or his agent about and says, and he's like halfway through writing, or 70% of the way through writing the Nancy Boys, and he says, "This book's terrible. It's going to be the worst book I've ever written. It's going to suck. Everyone's going to hate it." And you know what his editor tells him, or his agent tells him? "You do this every book. You call me and tell me this every book."
Every book.
And that's kind of what it is for me. I mean, I feel like I shouldn't say I feel like, because I really, I've been trying to keep more, better track of this, but almost every book has a break where I write something else in the middle.
And oh, interesting.
That's a really bad habit of mine, but I take a step back. I write another story. Usually I begin a different story, and then I go back and finish the original story. And that's in the best case scenario. Yeah. I'm a serial story abandoner, though.
Serial. I have a guy in my group who's a serial story abandoner. Like, I don't think he's ever finished a story. Beautiful writer. Sometimes he'll bring a full outline, and it'll be chapter by chapter, and it's great. And then we'll get maybe halfway through the book, and he's like, "No, done. New project." I'll be like, "Why do you do this every time?" It's sad.
Oh, it's brutal.
Yeah. It's brutal. Yeah. I'm like, you could have published all of these other books with maybe 3 more weeks of work, and you'd have like 10 books out there. But as it stands, you have none because you keep walking away. Just that serial abandonment. That's tough. Well, I'm glad you go back and finish, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I finish, you know, 15, 20 novels at this point. But I have you know, maybe 6 or 7 that are, especially from the past few years, that I've really gotten in, that I've left on the back burner for a long time. And actually, the Patreon story is one of those, which is why I have 60,000 words, but it's not done.
Mm.
And I really love that story, but it's, and this is serving as a kind of a way to motivate me to finish it finally.
I guess you mentioned in your previous serial publication, you published on your website as a way to generate traffic, and you say that it really works. So talk to me about how that worked for you. What were you doing to bring in people and whatnot?
Honestly, I didn't do a whole lot. I think that partially because the search terms are so good when you post a huge long post like that, people take notice. Huh. I also shared it around at places like Fiction Press. I think I did a little bit at Wattpad for a short while, but I didn't really like Wattpad very much for this kind of thing, especially because Wattpad, go on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're not writing for teenagers, you don't belong on Wattpad.
Absolutely. That's basically what I figured out. I was going to say something similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but I mean, if you're writing YA romance, go to Wattpad. Go, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That is golden for you if you're writing in that genre. If you're not, then you need to be writing YA. If you are not writing YA or romance, Wattpad is a waste of your time.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I've actually talked to some people who did Wattpad, who've done Wattpad and made some good success on it, but they were writing YA or romance or fan fiction or all three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I actually did, my previous interview was a writer on Wattpad who was doing really good, but she's writing YA fantasy. And, you know, she had done a ton of research. She was very organized, very technical, and she walked us through the whole thing. So it was great.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good. I might have to check that out. Yeah.
So, yeah, Amber Dalcourt is the interview. And so, yeah, she, like, if you are interested in Wattpad at all, I highly recommend that interview to you or your listeners, because she is not writing in the focal genre. She's not writing romance, but she has developed a following there by basically understanding the community really well.
Mm. That's neat. I mean, and community is really very, a very important part of any kind of fiction career, I think. Because you either have a very large community that just takes notice because there's so many of people, it's such a broad web like the traditional authors do, or you have to cultivate an audience like us independent authors do.
Yeah. Just by the volume of the story, it seemed to be bringing a lot of readers, but you weren't getting conversions off of that.
That's correct.
Have any idea or data behind why that wasn't working?
I think it was mostly because I wasn't good at producing ebooks at that point. I was still learning to do, like, I tried to do my own covers, and that really didn't work. I still don't quite get why people would read this story. Presumably a lot of people read the story. I know my stats.
Uh-huh.
But it could be that the people who were reading it that way just weren't interested in buying it, because they read the whole thing already. And they're like, whatever, dude, you know, I already got the story. And the people who I needed to attract through Amazon and the other websites I published at did not have the covers used to be really bad. I've recovered them since then.
Yeah, a bad cover will kill you in the market.
Yeah. And that was before I figured out that it's really quite easy to get cheap covers that are very effective. So
yes, it is. So
I mean, at least there's a mid-range of cover design. It's not super expensive.
So how are things going on Patreon? I know you haven't released your first book yet, but what are some of the avenues you're doing to reach more readers to pull into the Patreon project? And I guess how are you growing that platform?
Well, I have not put a lot of effort into it so far, to be honest. Sorry if that's disappointing. But I think what the main thing I've been doing is trying to do a YouTube channel. I'm trying to direct my podcast listeners there. My YouTube channel is pretty scarce at this point, but I'm starting to spin it up a little bit more. It takes a lot of time to do all this ancillary stuff, honestly. And I really do need to focus on writing another book as well as editing the serial and everything. So I actually kind of have a limited amount of time, even though I do have a lot of time on my hands these days. A limited amount of that time can really be spent on outreach that's pre-made. So mostly it's about how I share stuff. I mean, I make some of the posts public. That's actually something I think most people could take home if they want to start their own Patreon. I made the first posts public, so more people could get in. And I plan to make a few posts here and there public, maybe even the whole first chapter of the story will go public pretty, you know, a week after it launches, that kind of thing.
Okay.
And Patreon has a lot of good tools built in for doing that. So you can just set that, you know, say this is a early release, and then it goes to the next tier of, you know, patrons or the public viewing or whoever you designate at a certain date. And I think that's really neat.
Huh.
Yeah. Whereas it starts off only the people who pledged, you know, X dollars can see it.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, from your interview with Alexandra Penn, was there anything that you learned that maybe you haven't tried yet, but you thought was a good idea to kind of implement in this marketing approach to Patreon?
You know, It's been a bit. I do a lot of interviews, obviously, as you probably know. I mean, interviewing for a podcast can be a pretty vast job at some points, and things run together. But I'm not trying to just make excuses because I'm buying time. No, I think one of the most important things I learned is that you have to reach out to individuals, you cultivate people like that. And I don't mean like you reach out and say, please join my Patreon. You don't Facebook message somebody you barely know, or someone you know by any means, really. You don't go and say, check that out, it's whatever. I mean, I share everything I do to my Patreon, to my Facebook groups and stuff. I'm quite active on Facebook these days. And I think that's one of the big areas where, where it helps to share stuff. And, and to be a real person there first, then you can share stuff and people will take notice. I think that's kind of, I think the same thing's probably true on Twitter. I'm not very big and good at Twitter, but similar kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So. And yeah, but I'm probably the wrong guy to really be asking about Patreon. I'm very new there.
Okay. Well, you're the first one I've encountered who's trying it. I think I've heard of it vaguely, but maybe I'll have to do some research onto this.
You can check out Scott Roche is doing a serial story on Patreon right now.
Okay.
He's been on my podcast a couple times. Alexander Penn, both of them are a lot more successful than I am at this point. But I'm mine's only a few weeks old.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about craft. First of all, let's talk about, I've only read a few samples of your writing. I didn't get to read as much as I wanted to, just the first couple pages of a few different books. So what do you consider to be the strongest part of your craft, whether it be sentence, structures, descriptions, or story? And how did you develop that?
It's sad to me, but I think definitely my strongest bit of craft, at least of those three, would be sentences and style. However, this is not always a useful tool. That's why I say it's kind of sad, because you can use flourishes and language all you like, but if you don't know how to relate that into the story, it's not that big of a strength. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I did an interview with a New York Times bestselling author named, I cannot remember her last name. First name, Taylor Stevenson. And she had mentioned talking about craft. She said that her third book in her series is the best writing she's ever done, but she had done something with the language to the point that she was alienating some of her readers and it was her worst sales.
Oh yeah, that's totally possible. And frankly, I think characterization is probably still the thing that'll bring in the most people. Character and getting people to know your character really fast and solidly. You know, when you feel like you know somebody quick, like, have you ever had that experience in real life? Because I think it's definitely one of the most powerful things you can. It's like you just met somebody and now you're fast friends, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's rare, but it's very nice. Yeah,
that's happened to me a couple times in my life, and it's very unusual for me. So I don't know.
I've never heard it expressed that way, but I think that's very much the experience you want to give this reader, is this feeling of fast friends with your main character.
Right. Or at least that you've, in some cases, I think this is a good example of this, is the first, it's not a book, but the first season of True Detective has this, the first episode where you basically know enough about the character. You know enough about the main detective character played by, what's his name again? Not the older guy. Matthew McConaughey. Sorry, Matthew McConaughey's character comes off extremely clearly, extremely fast. I mean, but really, and he's a quite complex character. But you get the idea that he's very dark, and he's got this messed up kind of history. Even you don't have to know many specifics, so it's not an info dump. It's just this attitude that you get from him.
Yeah, I'll have to check it. I've heard so many good things about the first season of True Detective. I've just never gotten around to watching it. I'll have to.
Oh, yeah. Sorry to bring up something you're not aware. You're not under your.
I've heard a ton about it though. Like a ton about this. It's like on my list. Be like one day, someday, watch season one of True Detective.
Oh, it's Lovecraftian and Southern Gothic. It's really cool. But anyway, as far as how you do that in a story, I'm still learning that. I actually get to know my characters very slowly throughout when I'm writing the book. And as we discussed before, I'm a gardener. I discovery write my stories. And that's one of the big problems so far that I've encountered is a lot of, like, one of my the first novel I released, which was Hunter and Seed, is an urban fantasy novel with the protagonist not being all that clear to the readers for maybe 50, 60 pages. And then he doesn't, his raison d'etre doesn't really come out until maybe 100 pages in. Mm-hmm. And that's a big mistake. I mean, as much as I love that book, and I love that character, I wasn't putting enough on the page early on. So I can talk about my mistakes more easily than I can talk about my strengths, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Well, if you want to do that, we can go that direction.
No big deal. No big deal.
So what are some of the biggest writing mistakes that you've made? And what did you learn? You know, how did you learn to correct these issues?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the biggest one was probably not knowing understanding my audience when it came to writing fantasy, because it's mostly what I write, fantasy and science fiction. And both, and I like to write adventure fiction. Fiction is fun, but when I was in college, I was an English major, and I wrote this novel, this huge fat novel that had nothing happening in it.
that's the college novel everyone writes.
Yeah, but nominally it was an urban fantasy, and it didn't work at all. Because I was trying to write it to make my English professors happy as well as making myself happy, but really I didn't succeed in making anybody happy, and that's the problem with trying to split your audience. I should have cut off in hindsight, what you should do, and this is basically what I did with Hunter and Seed, which is set in the same kind of world as that original terrible novel. And Hunter and Seed, I think, is a quite good novel. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. That book is the same. It's the same setting. It's some of the same characters. But I said, to hell with the English literature crowd. They're never going to like this kind of book anyway. So goodbye. I'm going to go and do this for somebody who's more, I'm going to write a story for action fans and fans of things like Harry Dresden, maybe stuff like that.
Yeah. The Dresden Files. I'm familiar with those.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who isn't these days, especially in our kind of,
Oh, do you I didn't know. I mean, I knew Butcher, you know, I think he's a big seller, but I never thought he was a really huge name, but I guess the Dresden Files are referenced often enough. I'm like, well, maybe he's bigger than I thought he was.
Well, they did have a TV series for a little while.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I always think he was, I mean, it didn't last long, but I think he's pretty big in that, especially Dresden. But I think so understanding who your audience is, I think the self-publishing podcast they went through a period where they mentioned this quite a few times, where the hosts on that show would mention how you don't want to sell to try to sell everybody. Deliberately saying who you do not want in your fan in your audience can be very useful for determining who your book is actually for.
Yeah, that's actually a really good idea. Like, because I think particularly when authors are starting their careers, they're like, it's for everybody. Everybody's going to love my book. But then to tell them, be like, no, that's not true of any book ever written.
exactly.
So tell us who your book is not for, and that will really help you understand who you are writing for. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, it's like negative space when you're in drawing. Have you ever heard of this idea?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so... And for those listeners who haven't, it's where you draw what's not, you basically shape what's there by the empty stuff where you don't draw anything.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm not a good artist visually. In fact, I'm terrible, but I did manage to pass one drawing class one time. And I remember the negative space lessons quite well. Because that was the easy part.
Because that was the easy part. The part I don't do anything in? Awesome.
Exactly. That's a lesson that can actually be used very well with fiction as well. Because you don't want to be coy with fiction. This is a hobby horse of mine. If you're coy and you're not telling the reader what's going on inside your character's head, most importantly, you're coy with those details, that can be really devastating. And it can really make a story... just low impact, less powerful, you know?
Well, and that's the strength of our genre, or I should say our medium, because in no other form of fiction do you get that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to compete with film and plays and everything, then you have to bring the one thing they can't provide, which is the inner thoughts and feelings of the character.
Right, and the way their experience is unique. That's kind of the thing that I think is the most important part of that. It's not even necessarily like, oh, I'm thinking I'm angry. Like that's not good writing. Tom was angry, but then, but you instead describe how it feels to be an angry Tom, and then you can, and say, you know, especially if your character has unusual abilities. Like in my series, my Clean series, which is starts with the Mangrove Suite, those books, every character in those books has psychic abilities, basically. Every single person in that world has the ability to network over a psychic connection, basically. But everything in that world, I describe in a very sensory way. This is what I consider one of the bigger triumphs of that book for me.
Huh.
Because it's not just a network of thoughts and information. It's a network of feelings and sensory perceptions as well.
That's great. Okay. So if you could go back to yourself writing that first novel, you talked about, pick one audience, not two, to write for. What other advice would you give that writer sitting down on his first novel?
Well, if you're writing your first novel, I would say you actually don't need to worry about any of that, except for the audience thing is good. I think it's a good one to work from at basic, because it just influences your goal with the book, and intention is very important. But if you focus too much on the details of writing, because that wasn't actually my first book. This is also the guilty truth, is I had written six or seven books before that.
Oh, okay. So let's go back to the beginning. The first book, you sit down to write it. Now you can look at it and tell yourself, wow, what was I doing?
Oh,
and then what advice, what is the single or maybe two or three pieces of advice you tell that beginning author as he sits down to write that first novel?
I think the most important one, I'll just go with this, actually is still consider your audience. Who are you writing this book for? Because I know that's kind of redundant, but if you're writing the book for you, what do you love? Then just do that. You got to write something. You got to start somewhere. But if you have an idea of who you think will want to read this book, what do they love? Because it can go both ways. Does that make sense to you? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you have a goal in mind, an intention, and then really that trickles down. You can trickle that down to all levels of writing. So not to get too deep here, but for example, characters have goals. And those goals are, in world, but they also influence your goal with the story, which is to achieve a certain effect.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, so let's talk about another element of prose. So when you're reading something, you pick up a book and you start reading, what is an element of prose or storytelling that just drives you crazy when it's done poorly?
Okay, I wanted to say narration, but that's too general. I think the basics of telling details. If the telling detail is where, for people who aren't aware of this terminology, is where you actually just describe. You just say something. Say he was this. She did that. She was that. And that's not a bad thing in and of itself. But when it's done clumsily, it's really bad. I'm not sure exactly how. Overusing it is the first step to doing that clumsily. But a whirlwind effect, like sometimes people try to do, I'm thinking of one particular example, but let's not name names here. There's this attempt to do, it was the summary at the beginning of a second book. And I was trying to read it, and I say trying because I didn't get very far. I am a bit of a snob. Never let anyone say otherwise. But this is a summary of the previous book, in some ways, but it flowed very fast. There was like a list of events and they didn't really connect in a logical way, or because I actually had not read the first book. I was just reading samples here. But it drove me insane to try to get through this opening bit. It
was like, yeah. That's funny. Okay. So,
I was trying to make sure this series was right for me by checking out the beginning of both books. I was giving it more of a try than just one,
Well, that's, that's a lot more than most people would give it. That's bold to give it that many. So I know.
Go on.
I was going to say, I know some writers, they'll say that when they're trying something, they'll read three or four chapters. I'm like, you get one chapter out of me. That's it. If I'm trying your workout, if you bungle chapter one, I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
I think prose style is probably what I'm really describing here, but because I say style is one of my strong suits, and I am a snob when it comes to style.
Yeah. Well, I think
becoming a writer makes you a style snob, right? Like, and here's the odd thing. There's a lot of like best-selling books that you can pick and be like, oh my word, this is not written very well.
Mm-hmm.
But their story craft is strong enough, and there's enough readers who are not snobs that it still works.
Right. And I think that's actually a real virtue, not the snobbery, but the non-snobbery is a real virtue that many, the people who are just readers have over most writers.
Yeah. Like it's sad when you pick up a book from an author whose stories you've enjoyed before and you can't get through it because you can no longer tolerate their prose. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, welcome to being a writer. That's why we have audiobooks. So you don't have to look at it, at least.
Yeah. And actually, I find do you ever find that audiobooks makes it easier to deal with subpar prose? I think it does.
Yeah, I do. So like Dan Brown, I enjoy his stories. I cannot read his books, but I can listen to them. And so that's what I do, is I always do an audio with a Dan Brown.
Okay. Yeah.
I just can't handle it. I just can't do it.
You said the magic word. Dan Brown was actually the writer that got me into writing, because I despised the Da Vinci Code, mostly the style of it, so much. I was so frustrated, and this was back, I was very young. I think I was a middle schooler in United States terminology. And I read this book, and I just remember thinking, I could do better than that. I got to do better than that. And that's how it started.
Yeah, that is funny. But yeah, and so like I can't read his prose. I like have a really hard time with it. And I think he gets mocked fairly often, but his story craft is strong enough that readers who aren't pro snobs don't care. They still enjoy his stories.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think in hindsight, I don't see a whole lot wrong with his stories. But I definitely was, it definitely was an inciting incident, to use the book term.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm definitely a pro snobs as well. And you know, like I said, most people I'll give a first chapter, but if you had bad prose, you get maybe a page, because mm-hmm. I just have a low tolerance for it. Because I mean, that's the nature of becoming a writer. As you study it and you learn about it and you learn how to do it well, suddenly you can spot when it's not being done well.
Yeah, right. Though it's also, I think it's also the general, I mean, if you're familiar with the meaning of the word sophomore, it's very much a sophomore thing to begin with, because it starts off with you thinking, I know better than that guy. That guy's making obvious mistakes, blah, 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 you know, all these mistakes. But I know better, and I am doing better. But the fact is, you're still a new writer in a lot of, you know, not saying you are, but, you know, in this case, this example, the person saying that is often a really, really new writer. Like, people who say J.K. Rowling's prose isn't very good, for example. Her prose is fine, but it's not, I mean, it's not perfect. But it's not terrible. It's fine. And the people who go around criticizing people like that who are you know, above par writers, probably, or at least reasonable writers in most cases. When you go around criticizing that kind of thing, that can be the bad side of snobbery, instead of just learning from it, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think you have a real point there, but I mean, I think part of this is, if you encounter success early as a writer, I think your prose do suffer, because you don't have to address that as much.
You know, I agree.
You write that first novel and it's a huge hit right away. Well, you don't go through most writers go through, which is years of critique groups and having your work just destroyed over and over. And then suddenly you can see those small details, you know?
Right.
So like Taylor Stevenson, you know, she's a New York Times bestselling author, does very well. And she said, there's a lot of luck in this business. There's a lot of luck. And that's just the nature of the beast.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's pretty maddening at times.
Yeah. So, okay. So talk to me about just growing your platform in general. Let's go back to before Patreon. What are some of the things you do to bring in new readers in general?
Well, I try to be as present on my websites and stuff as possible. I mean, which seems odd, because I haven't blogged much recently. I have a blog. I have two podcasts that I do regularly. These are kind of my outreach. I recently discovered email list swaps, which are so far really, really cool. That's so far been the most effective way to actually drive sales, is to get is to make friends with other authors and who have, you know, say a list, a following in your genre. And yeah. And I know this to me is very daunting. I've only started doing this recently, but it's extremely daunting. But this is the only way I've found that actually drives sales, because it's the only way you're going to reach out to people who you know are interested in your kind of book, is to find other people who write your kind of books, who are farther along, and ask for their help.
Yeah.
And that's why it's kind of useful to have a podcast, though, to be honest. And and that's not why I started the podcast. I started the podcast because I thought it'd be fun, and I'm a huge podcast fan.
Oh, I started the podcast to build platform.
Okay, so at least one of us was on the right page. I'm not sure. But I thought, okay, I'll start a podcast and we'll see what happens. And my podcast, one of them is very niche, but it's actually the more popular one, which is the role playing game podcast. But Alive After Reading, just because it's younger, is actually a good way to meet other writers. And then I can offer, and I've just recently thought, you know, I could offer people guest spots on the show or special edition episodes or something like that as a way to, because my newsletter isn't really worth a swap at this point. It's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a whole lot of people, and most of them are not super engaged. So I think it's well worth having other ways you can exchange. It sounds really mercenary when you put it this way, but it's exchange of services, you know, exchange.
It is. I mean, it's quid pro quo, right? I do you a favor, you do me a favor, and we both benefit.
Exactly. And I as sleazy as that made me sound and makes me feel, really, I think it's a valuable ability. And honestly, writer communities are very useful for this kind of thing. But I think having something that you can offer, and it's not, I mean, I don't work that hard on my podcasts. I think anyone who listens to them can tell that. As much as I hope people enjoy them, I enjoy them. I really enjoy doing them. I just don't have certain technical skills that make it super polished. I don't know Dan Carlin or.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Isn't he amazing? Yeah, I love Dan Carlin.
I'm no Dan Carlin. Let's just leave it at that. And I don't think I have the guts to be Dan Carlin. He's really crazy. I mean, making his whole living off the podcasting now. Come on.
So, hardcore history, yeah. You know, he's so engaging.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so rich and well-researched. I mean, realistically, a Dan Carlin episode that he'll release is as good as an audiobook. Like, it makes sense that he's making a living off podcasting.
Oh yeah, it's like as long as an audiobook now these days.
Yeah, they are. They're like six hours and there's like six parts, you know. I mean, it's like 24 hours of content right there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The Death Throes of the Republic, a very classic. That was like the beginning of the modern hardcore history series. And it was just, you know, that was 36 hours or something, or 40, it was like 25 hours at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's like awesome. A very in-depth history book that he's creating. Yeah. So, I mean, and not only that, but he teaches history in a way that is gripping.
Right. He's a storyteller. He uses the voice of the storyteller to describe history. But he understands how to tell a story with his voice.
And yes.
It's language, but it's a different kind of use of the, it's not obviously because it's not on paper. And I think people sometimes underestimate how big a difference that really is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as much a performance as it is a story.
Absolutely. So, I want to do a brief plug for my favorite hardcore history series, which was actually before he started really doing the giant shows. It's only about 4.5 hours long total, but the Ghosts of the Ostfront. If you've not listened to that, you need to listen to it. Anyway, it's amazing.
Okay, so your outreach, you have these two podcasts that you were doing, you're networking with your writing communities, and that's kind of how you've been doing your marketing.
Yes. Right? Yeah. I try to find other people's readers, and I think I'm going to try to do that even more in the future.
Yeah. I think that's the ideal, because these people are readers, and if you're doing it right, they're readers of your genre. And, you know, I'm a big reader, and there's never enough good content that I want to read in a given year. There's never enough, and I'm always hunting for more. And I think that's the story with any big reader, is the stuff we really love, there are not enough people producing it yet.
Mm-hmm. And it's true of everything, really. I mean, like look at our independent genres. There's military space opera or military science fiction / space opera. This is a subgenre which has exploded over the past couple of years, especially independently. And it is just, it's intimidating to even look at it, because these people are, I mean, there are a lot of readers in that genre, and they were not being served by the modern traditional publishing community.
Yeah. Well, and I think you've got a good point. Like, every couple of years, new genres are made because we realize, oh, there's a lot of people who want these kinds of stories. We didn't even know.
Right. Yeah. Lit RPG. You ever heard of that?
Yeah, I have. Like, it's a new... It's a new genre kind of emerging for people who like MMO game stories.
Yeah, exactly. And or like the anime Sword Art Online is kind of an example for me, almost kind of like Ready Player One, but not really. Ready Player One's kind of
One's like a bridge into genre.
Exactly. So this is the kind of thing that's really exciting to me. I mean, I've always liked really weird stories, and honestly, my genre, like I just mentioned, I have two techno fantasy series which I've been serializing. Come on, I mean, techno fantasy, who even reads that? That's probably the scariest part for me.
Yeah. Games have been made in techno fantasy for some time now.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Absolutely. By techno fantasy, I meant like, I'm referring to the idea of having advanced technology in a world that's not Earth.
Yeah, right.
Just to be clear.
So I think, I mean, you could even make the case that Star Wars is its own kind of techno fantasy, right?
Yeah, and then so far it basically looks like space opera, or it is space opera.
Yeah, it's a space opera in a techno fantasy world, because the technology is far advanced, but they have the Force, which makes it fantasy.
Right, absolutely. So... it is a genre blend in some sense too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so, I mean, so we have fantasy, you know, which Tolkien really kind of invented was the fantasy genre. And, you know, but then people said, what happens when these worlds advance technologically? And so that's where you kind of get that. Some people call it sci-fi fantasy, other people call it techno fantasy, but it's that idea of this world where there is magic and then they develop technology because they're not in the Middle Ages endlessly.
Exactly. I actually think most fantasies that are going to say, oh, this world is never going to advance beyond this point, have to have a reason why that's the case. or you lose me.
So, but yeah. All right. So that's everything I had on my end. Is there anything you thought you'd want to bring up or mention about writing craft or style or marketing that has worked or hasn't worked for you that you'd want to share with the audience?
I think I've gone off on enough tangents.
Okay. Well, why don't you give us a shout out? Tell us where they can find you and your writing and just everything in case they're interested.
Sure. You can find my website is mentalcellarpublications.com, and it's cellar with a C. So it's a mental basement. That's the idea. And you can find me on Amazon.com. Most of my new books are Kindle exclusive, or Amazon exclusive, I should say. However, most of my books are wherever you can find them. And you can also follow me on YouTube. My Patreon is patreon.com/tneeder or tneederwriter. Damn it, I wish I could remember. Anyway, I'm new at this. That's about it.
All right. Well, hey, this has been great. Oh, why don't you, if people are interested in your writing, where do you think they should start? Where would you send them first?
I actually think you should start with the latest series. It's The Mangrove Suite. That one's exclusive to Amazon, but it does kind of encapsulate what I'm about, especially lately. And I mentioned at the beginning of the show. So just, The Mangrove Suite on Amazon.com.
So, all right. Thanks for your time. This has been great.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. So this episode will come out on March 9th. We will be releasing our newsletter with the big changes this month. So we are going to be linking to thousands and thousands of keywords for you to be able to run in your Amazon ads. I found that I was spending a lot of time finding keywords, and other authors were finding those exact same keywords, spending hours and hours as well. And it's like, why don't we just all share? So we've dug in and spent a little more extra time gathering some keywords and genres we're not writing in. And we are going to be sharing all of those with everybody through the newsletter. So you can get your link there to to access those. We would also love to help you out with your blurbs. If you want to send in a blurb to us, if it's a very detailed blurb, that should be enough that we can do a couple rewrites on it. But some blurbs I've read, I don't even know what the story is about by the time I get to the end of the blurb. So if you also want to send in just a one-page book report. Now, I say that it doesn't need to be catchy. It doesn't need to be interesting. You just need to communicate to me what this book is about. And then we will work on the blurb and at least get you one version, maybe two or three. And then we'll read the original and one that we've written up on the podcast just to kind of show people the techniques and whatnot. We've just gotten a lot of really good feedback on the blurb. So we're going to, you know, try this as a while as we still try to push those two episodes, Blurb Theories Part 1 and 2, just because we've gotten so much positive feedback from them and a lot of people have really enjoyed them. So feel free to email those blurbs to jbendoski@gmail.com. And if you go to the website, joseph-bendoski.com, that's bendoski.com, you can sign up for the newsletter there and we will get you those keywords. And we would love it if you would just tell other authors. We know a lot of authors spend a lot of time gathering keywords. And so we just want to take that weight off of a lot of writers' shoulders so that they can spend more time writing. And as always, thanks for listening.